Welcome to another episode of Dollars and Cents, Wealth, Wisdom, and Well-Being. Join us as we explore fascinating topics and thought leaders, innovators, and trailblazers from all walks of life. I'm John Carolyn, Senior Vice President and Portfolio Manager for Main Street Wealth Management Group.
And I'm Mark Lopez, Senior Vice President, Olympic Silver Medalist, and Certified Financial Planner with Main Street Wealth Management Group. Together, we bring you insights that can help build a secure and prosperous future.
So, and today, we're honored to welcome a very, very special guest, Mr. John Yao, an expert legal authority in estate planning. With over two decades of experience, John has been a guiding force for families looking to protect their legacies. John, welcome. We're thrilled to have you here today.
Gentlemen, thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
All right. Now, John, we always like to kick off our episodes with a bit of fun trivia. So, John, here's one for you. What percentage of Americans do you think do not have a will or any kind of estate plan in place?
Well, I happen to know that because I run across it all the time and I've questioned people about it. But what do you think? What do you find?
I would say over 50%.
Yeah, the numbers, it always surprises me.
Me too, what, yeah.
But tell us.
I've always heard 60%, and I see a lot of them. You know, when someone dies without a will and you have to do an heirship proceeding, there's a lot of them. So.
Yeah, well, the actual answer is, yeah, around 60%, and it's quite a staggering number considering how crucial estate planning is for protecting your loved ones and assets. Now, why do you think so many people just put it off and not want to talk about it? And how do you think they could take the first step to ensure their estate is properly managed?
I think one reason people put it off is because I think they think as soon as they do it, they'll die. I mean, that's what I hear from people. I don't know. But to take a first step, you just need to talk to somebody who does estate planning. And especially, you know, there's things you can do on your own. And I don't know how well they work. The ones I see didn't work very well. And so I have to go through an extra step to make the will work in court. But it's just good to talk to an estate planning attorney about that.
Yeah, we see it all too often. And the difference that some proper planning would have done in someone's life would have made such a big difference to their loved ones. So let's kind of go back here. And before we go any further, rewind to the beginning of your journey, John. You know, you've been doing this for a long time. Can you tell us a bit about how you got started and what drew you to estate planning?
Well, I'll tell you honestly, I have an undergraduate degree in music, and I decided I better get some other kind of degree so I could make a living. So I started going to law school at night and got enthralled with it. So I've been practicing. I practiced a couple of different areas early on, and one of the cases I had early on was a will contest. The attorney on the other side was very gentlemanly about the whole thing. I thought, that's the area of law I want to be in. Plus, I remember it from law school as being very interesting. So it covers kind of all of life, you know, and death, I suppose, too. But it's a very interesting area of law. It's intellectually interesting as well as just sort of factually interesting.
Well, we are lucky to have people like you that find estate planning interesting, because there are other fields in the world like accounting, and some people would say finance, you know, the business we're in is boring. So everybody has their place and everybody enjoys whatever they think is entertaining for them. So we're happy that you like it. Now, John, every successful person has someone who influenced their journey. Who was that for you, and how did they help you grow into the trusted legal authority that you are today?
Well, I hadn't thought about this in a long time, but the thing that happened is I said I was doing sort of a general law practice in which you're not an expert in anything, unfortunately. But I was doing a lot of litigation, and the person on the other side of the will, I took a will contest. The person on the other side was an attorney. I think he may still practice, named Randall Lamb. And he was so professional and so reasonable to deal with. I don't remember how the case went, but it was a pleasure to deal with him. And I thought, this is an area of law where it will be fun to be, you know. So that's how I got into it. Like I said, I remembered it as having enjoyed the courses in law school. I don't know why I didn't go into it right away, but I'm very glad I did.
It's a wonderful answer. And to me, the more and more that we learned about estate planning and all the things that it entails, the more interesting it became to all of us. So let's start with the basics, John. What are key elements of an effective estate plan, and why is having both a will and a trust important for many or most people?
Okay. Well, I'll tell you, there's the first thing I tell people is you need a will because that's for your family. When you die, if they don't have a will and you have any assets whatsoever that you want to bequest to somebody else, especially if you have real estate, but anything, then if you don't have a will, then they're going to have to do what's called an heirship proceeding, H-E-I-R-S-H-I-P, and determine who your heirs are. The court has to determine who your heirs are. And that essentially doubles the cost of a regular probate. And also, if you have a will, you name an executor to handle your estate. In Texas, this law is different from state to state, but in Texas, the default type of administration is called a dependent administration, and that's the more expensive type of administration. If you have a will, you can name somebody to be an independent administrator, an independent executor, and to serve without a bond, and that simplifies the legal costs and the timeframes involved. So
we've seen this quite a few times, and especially with the family, right? And if there are many heirs to an estate, it can be so messy. And we've seen, unfortunately, you know, the infighting and things that can happen within siblings, and just because everything wasn't written down, right? There weren't clear instructions. Is that what you see?
In my experience, people will fight over a little or a lot. It doesn't matter. And they just say, I want justice. I don't care how much it costs, and I want my brother on the stand to admit he's wrong. Well, none of that's going to happen. You're going to care how much it costs very quickly. Justice is sometimes suggest subjective, but people don't get on the stand like Perry Mason and admit they're wrong very often. So I try to dissuade people from that attitude right from the beginning. But that's if you're really in litigation. I don't do that anymore. I used to do it for a long time, but I don't practice trial law anymore.
Yeah, I think more people ought to think about things like that, you know, where just proper planning, and you can avoid things that in arguments where Christmas time comes and there's an empty seat at the table or Thanksgiving, and because you have the infighting within siblings and family members, it's so important.
Can I tell you a little story about that?
Absolutely.
There's a jazz musician who's a singer in town who's always been very kind to me, and I've gotten to know him pretty well over the years, but he didn't have any money. And his daughter asked me if I would help with his estate planning, and I said I'd be delighted to. And I said, so we're going to do, we did the power of an attorney. We haven't discussed that yet, but those are very important while you're alive to have those. And then I went ahead and wrote a will for him, and she said, well, he didn't have anything. I said, you know what? He's got like 5 children. He's got a lot of memorabilia. He wants it to go to you. Let's have a document that says it goes to you. And that way we kind of minimize the infighting, you know? So
I guess that's a great segue to my next question to you, John, which is many people assume that estate planning is only for the extremely rich. Can you break that myth for us and explain why estate planning is vital for everyone, regardless of the size of their estate?
If you have anything that you want, first of all, if you have a will, it allows you to designate where some of your property is going to go. It's not going to go what the state of Texas says are to your legal heirs. And there's all kinds of tables of who your legal heirs are or charts of that, but and depending on the circumstances. But you can, number one, you can designate where your property is going to go. You don't have to have a lot for it to be important where your property goes. Number one, if you have a house, it really simplifies getting you got to transfer title of your house one way or the other. And that's really how laws started, I think, is just transferring interest in real property. But I haven't been around quite that long. But no, it doesn't matter. And if you have sometimes you need – I do this so much I sort of know it inherently, but I'm not sure how easy to explain. If you have a bank account that just is in your name, for example – Or it's not only just in your name, but it's a joint account, but it's not a joint account with right of survivorship or payable on death. To be able to get the decedent's money out of that account, the bank may well want what's called letters testamentary. And that's an official document that you get from the court when you have a will. Or if you don't have a will, you get letters of administration. Same thing, but you have to get those formal documents before banks will release the money. Banks are very suspicious because they don't want 5 different people coming and asking for the same money. And again, if you don't have a will and you have to do the heirship proceeding, it almost doubles the cost of probate.
So let me ask you this. You're telling me somebody has a joint tenants in common account and it's a joint account, somebody passes away. The surviving spouse in this example would not have immediate access to those funds.
Theoretically, that's true. I mean, if the bank doesn't know you died, maybe they can get the person died, the other people, you can transact. But what happens is this. If you have, when my mother was ill and thinking about dying, I set up an account for her that was, she had her regular bank accounts. And then I set up one that was called a joint tenancy with right of survivorship. And that's very specific language in Texas. And what that meant was that when she passed away, and I was the joint tenant on the account, when the money came immediately to me, so I'd have money for her funeral expenses and costs, all of that kind of stuff, you know? And so, and I recommend that people do that. But if it's just a joint account, mom or pop, then the bank can freeze it. If one of the people are still alive, I don't run into that very often, because often people just keep transacting business out of the account and the bank, until the bank knows. And I'm not encouraging that. I'm just saying that's what happens a lot. If it's a joint account with, if one of the spouses is alive, one of the joint, they can probably still do transactions in that account. But they don't own the money in that account. And so that the, especially if they haven't put any money in, if it's just the parent's account with the child's name on it, but it's not a right of survivorship account, they don't really own that money. I'm sort of embarrassed. I don't remember exactly what all the parameters are of that, but.
I mean, what that tells me is that the way things are titled is very, very important. I think that oftentimes it's not explained well enough to people. Like, I don't know. Thinking back, you know, all the different bank accounts that I'd opened over the years, I don't really remember anybody ever explaining how that worked to me. And I'm sure that that is something that goes on all the time.
It goes on all the time. The problem is that the law that affects this is, in Texas, is Texas law. And people in banks that are headquartered in other states don't necessarily know, I'm not saying they don't all know, but they don't necessarily know Texas law. So I know one bank in town that for a long time was setting up every new bank account as a joint tenancy with right of survivorship. That means the joint tenant on that account just owned the money at the date of the original owner's death. And the problem with that, number one, is that passes, it's called a non-probate asset. It passes outside of the wishes you set forth in your will. So it just goes, it's a contract. So it goes outside, it's like life insurance a lot of times. It goes outside of probate and the will has no effect on how it's distributed. And a lot of people will do that. They'll set up a lot of what are called non-probate accounts with right of survivorship and named beneficiaries and that sort of thing. And a lot of those are good, but if you don't have any that go into the estate, there's no money, for example, to pay estate debts and expenses, you know. It doesn't invalidate your will, just your will, your property's not necessarily going where you intended it to go.
Now, just to get back to my question, on the other side of the spectrum are the extremely rich. A lot of the clients that we work with are high net worth individuals. Can you talk a little bit about estate tax and what somebody has to be worth if they pass away to where their heirs would be subject to that estate tax?
Yeah, I can a little bit. There's an exemption amount under which you don't have to pay estate tax. And I've sort of forgotten what it is. It's so high now. I'm sure it's well over $11 million. Maybe it's $15 million. I don't know. But I don't deal with it very often because I don't know many people that have that much money. But not just money, but assets in total. And when they look at – the IRS looks at your estate for estate tax purposes. They look at everything you own, including non-probate assets, like an account where you name somebody. I believe life insurance is included in that, all of your real estate. And what people do a lot of times – maybe I'm digressing, but they'll have the separate trust called the – Irrevocable Life Insurance Trust, and they'll put a life insurance policy in there, and that is designated to fund payment of the estate tax. So much of their estate isn't eaten up by estate tax.
Because that's a pretty egregious tax, right? What's the penalty?
Yeah, I think from what I understand, say a couple's worth, right now I think the exemption amount is $13 million
per person. Yeah.
So
yeah.
Combined, it's $26 million. So God forbid a couple died in a plane crash and their estate was worth, let's keep math simple, $50 million. So then they would have an exemption amount of 26 or so. So $24 million is taxable to the estate. So then of that $24 million, I believe roughly 40% is going to be taxed, which the heirs would have to produce from the estate. And I guess from what you said, John, a way to pay for that estate tax is through a life insurance policy, correct?
That's correct. And another thing is that if a lot of your wealth is in real estate or something else that's not liquid, and you got to pay that tax.
Or a farm.
Or a farm, exactly. The family farm or you know anything. Then you got to figure out how to pay that tax unless you're going to liquidate the assets.
Or even a business, because a lot of business owners' wealth is in their business,
yeah.
And it's not readily liquid for the heirs to sell that business.
And so you're talking about now, potentially, depending on what's going on with the economy, having a fire sale to pay the estate tax.
And from what I understand, after the Trump tax plan expires January 1, 2026, I believe those lifetime exemptions go down to like 7 million each. So then anything above 14 million or so is going to be taxable at 40% to the heir, something like that.
The estate tax has been off my radar for sure all this time, you know, because we used to do wills and trust with trust in them that were to minimize estate tax. So we'd have a bypass trust and stuff like that. And but I haven't done any of those in a while because there haven't been that many people that have that much money that at least come to my office.
So most people don't have to worry about estate tax in the United States.
That's correct, yeah.
But I would think that if that exemption comes down to where you're saying, what, seven million
each, around there?
Then, I mean, you're obviously going to have a lot more people that are going to fall into that, especially people that own, like a family-owned business or small business owner, where it's all tied up in their business. So,
and you can get there pretty fast, that number, because it includes your life insurance and your house and everything. But I saw a lot before the exemption amount started. You know, for a long time, it was like $600,000 was the exemption amount. It was like that for a lot of my career. And so we were writing those things all the time. And that's how those living trusts got started, got so big with people putting bypass trusts and those things in there. So
another thing you touched upon, and it's pretty interesting, is when you're talking about probate. And before kind of get into that, I heard a story about the actor John Wayne, and that he used to, wherever he made a movie, he would buy a property. And apparently that he didn't, I guess, not title it, what's the word I'm looking for? Well, he didn't have the proper estate planning in with that. And because of that happening, they had to probate his will in every single state in which he had a property. And rumor has it that estate planner is still doing business with John Wayne. How long has he passed away? What, 1980 or 79, something like that?
That's when I recommend, as a general rule, I don't generally recommend living trust just automatically. But if you've got real estate in another state, if most states would require you to probate the will as what's called an ancillary administration in that state, which is an extra expense. And so that's otherwise you can't transfer title of the property in that state. So what people will do is if they can title the property in the name of a trust, then they don't have to do that.
Oh, okay. I got you. So let's kind of go back to the probate. So it's a term people fear. I don't think that they really understand what it really is. Can you explain what it is, in layman's terms, why it happens and how, as you were describing, how good estate planning can help streamline that process or even avoid it?
I'd be happy to. I think the word probate means or is proved. You prove who owns something and who's the successor owner. So, and most probate, if you have a will and you can have an independent administration and the executor can serve without a bond, that's the most streamlined way of actually having a formal probate in Texas. There's a few other things that under certain circumstances you could do different kinds of procedures, but the normal thing is to probate a will, okay? And what you're doing when you're probating, it's not that bad a thing. It's not even that expensive. You file the will with the court with an application to probate it, and you're asking the court to sign off an order saying this is the true and correct will of the decedent, okay, that it meets the requirements to be a proper will. And to appoint somebody, the will appoints somebody to be the executor, but the court, they don't have any authority until the court says you're the executor, and that they're, you have to qualify them to show that if you have to have a bond, then you post a bond and an oath, and that qualifies them. And you have to put up some evidence that they're not disqualified, I'm always afraid that they're not a felon or something, but I'm always afraid to ask that I forgot my ask my client to go into court. And I say, by the way, you don't have any felonies. Yeah, they're taking away tomorrow. You know, I'm great. So it hasn't happened yet, the court kind of makes sure the people who are going to handle the estate, the person that's going to handle the estate is not a bad actor as best they can. We do it by Zoom all the time, and they may set just these simple ones, if they're uncontested, they may set 7 or 8 of these for the same 1-hour hearing because they don't take that long, and they're not this very straightforward stuff.
Yeah, somebody tell me how accurate this is, but in Texas, at least, probate's not that big a deal in that sometimes it would take you longer to find a parking spot at the courthouse than it takes to actually go through probate.
I don't know this, but I think Texas is unique in having this independent administration that's so abbreviated for normal good people. You know?
Texas is a good place to live and a good place to die.
That's right.
That clears it up a lot. You heard it first here, probate, to prove.
Yeah, well, it makes sense in Spanish. Probar is to prove. For those English, probar.
And in other states, it's more like, instead of to prove, it's more like prostate, probate prostate, because it sounds, that's like the exam you're going to get if you don't do it right. So,
well, John, as the listeners of our podcast know, I'm the certified financial planner of the team. And my job is to always think for the worst or plan for the worst and hope for the best. So in our meetings that we have with our clients, I usually bring up, you know, their estate plan, make sure everything's good, but also bring up the potential situation, sad situation where somebody might become incapacitated. And I talk about power of attorney and things like that. It's uncomfortable to talk about, but it's something that it should be brought up just in case, right? Plan for the worst. So can you talk to us a little bit about powers of attorney and living wills and things of that nature?
Okay. Powers of attorney are absolutely essential. They're for you before you die. Okay. And while you're still alive, but if something happens to you that you can't handle your own financial matters and you can't handle your own health care, then you need somebody to do that for you. And if you have a situation where it's a, you know, maybe you're in a car wreck and you're out for unable to do it for weeks or something like that, but then you recover, then that's fine. They can handle it while you're unable to do so. If you become an old man like me and get mentally incapacitated, I'm not admitting that, but my wife's a guardianship lawyer. I have to be careful about these things. But the if you become incapacitated and like permanently, if you have powers of attorney, generally you're okay. You don't have to have a guardianship. And guardianships are expensive to set up, number one. They're long and to set up. They're expensive to set up. And they'll basically go on the rest of your life. And so in a guardianship, you have to do, after you get the thing set up, you have to do annual accounts for whatever assets are in there, and you have to do well-being reports, and you have to – the courts are so protective of the care for the well-being and the financial well-being of a person over whom a guardianship has been set up. You have to practically file an application for every breath you take as the guardian. There's ways to streamline that. You do what's called an application and get an order for a monthly allowance. So that's so every month you don't have to file a new one for the monthly expenses. You estimate what the expenses are, that the court approves them, and then you can draw those out of the guardianship account for a year.
Give me a scenario in which, worst case scenario, somebody doesn't have
powers of attorney.
Powers of attorney. Like what are the consequences of not having that?
If you become mentally incapacitated, somebody's got to have the authority to handle your finances, your health care, and maybe your living situation, you know, where you live. And if you don't have any of these powers of attorney, it's going to be a guardianship, or most likely to. There's not many situations I can think of where it's not. And so I really encourage people, guardianships, they're great things, but they're expensive.
And that's, again, very, very important that people have those documents in place. But expand on guardianships a little bit. So when would somebody, what's a good example of when someone would want to have a guardianship set up?
Yeah, when you have, you're interested in the welfare of somebody, whether it's a relative or not, I think that's the test. When my mother was ill with a long, protracted illness and losing her ability to think very clearly, she had powers of attorney, so we weren't so worried about it. But I was also named to be her guardian if we ever came to that. If something happened that the powers of attorney got challenged, I don't know what would happen. I've never had that happen. But then I was set up to be the guardian. What would I'd have to do? I'd have to myself or have another lawyer file an application of a guardian. And when you do that, these days you're supposed to have a doctor's letter with it. There's we call it a doctor's letter. It's 3 or 4 pages, a doctor's physician certificate. And that's when there's some psychiatrists, especially in Houston, that are real specialists in this sort of thing and are trusted by everybody, trusted by the courts. I filed one a few weeks ago for a lady whose family thought couldn't care for herself, physically or mentally she couldn't, and that people were getting her money, that people were tricking. And that happens a lot, you know.
Taking advantage of somebody that's incapacitated.
People, yeah, to get them on the phone. I don't know how they do it, but— So they came to us, so we filed the application for the guardian, and we have the client, this particular client is a nephew, wants to be the guardian. We filed an application for that. Before we filed it, we got a doctor's letter, and then the physician certificate, filed all those together. Then we asked the court to appoint an attorney ad litem, and that's another attorney that's not a really big expense generally, but it's another attorney to basically be the advocate for the person over whom the guardianship is sought. They call it the proposed ward. You know, somebody has to speak in their defense. If they want to object to the guardianship, they have a right to object to it, even if they're not real lucid. And so the attorney ad litem has to represent them as their attorney, separate and apart from the person who's seeking.
Okay.
But that's generally not a very – it can be, but it's generally not a very big role for an attorney. I do it all the time, but I might make a few hundred dollars, a few thousand dollars at the top. Doesn't usually – unless it's just an unusual case, it doesn't go on very long. That appointment as an attorney ad litem.
So guardianship is it's another layer of added protection to make sure that somebody who doesn't have, you know, whatever their own, let's just say mentally incapacitated or whatever the reason, that they're not taken advantage of by the bad actors out there.
Yeah. And can be family members. It can be anybody.
Oh, yeah.
You know? So, yeah, it's a very – it's the courts are – and there's been lots over the years. There's been lots of news reports and stuff about this person or that person being taken advantage of or by their attorney. Any fees that I make in a guardianship that are being taken out of the ward's estate, the court has to approve. I have to apply to the court for approval of my fees and make sure – and they have to say these are just or this one isn't and this one is. And then they can approve a certain amount of my fees to be paid out of the guardianship estate. So there's a lot to it. I don't get attorney's fees for filing one of those applications, but I do for filing all those other applications for expenditures of estate assets and that sort of thing. So, and when they invest money, the ward's money, the courts are very careful about what they'll let you invest in because they have to be very conservative investments. So I don't know. Do y'all handle some – you probably do it as a trust or something.
Mostly trusts. No guardianships that I know of. It's typically in a trust.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
But it's very similar, I guess, in that you'll have different guidelines and you have to stay within the guardrails.
Yeah. Well, if you have a trust and you have powers of attorney, you might have to get into a guardianship. I mean, I think they're good things, but they're just – it's a good idea to avoid them if you can. So just because of the expense.
Well, that's really interesting. You learn something new every day.
All right, let's get into another morbid topic that I want to bring up. Talking about the situation where you become in bed at a hospital and you can't wake up from a coma. And me personally, I don't want to be a vegetable for 10 years, right? Just pull the plug. How do you avoid that happening?
Well, the best thing you can do, there's a document that people call a living will, and it's formally called the directive to physicians. And it says, if I am in, and it has certain languages, if I am likely to die in 6 months, I don't remember exactly what it says, but that to that effect, either keep me alive by all available means or don't use all available means and let me die comfortably. That's the essence of it. It's not, I don't have one in front of me, so I don't remember exactly what it says. And so the person, when they're executing the other estate planning documents, they just put their initials in the line that says they choose those things. There's probably some other things to choose in there. But so the hospitals, I'll tell you, when you go into the hospital, one of the first things they ask you is, do you have a directive to physicians? Because they don't want a bunch of people lying around in beds that they have to support for some period of time. So that's the best thing to do.
But how does that work like in real life? So say, God forbid, I'm driving down, you know, I-10 or 59, and I get in an accident and I can't think for myself. I'm in the hospital and they say I won't live unless I'm assisted by some kind of breathing machine.
Well, actually, I've seen your will, and yours just says put a pillow over your face.
Never mind. That clears everything up.
That's what mine says.
So there's no way I can provide them with a directive to physician because I'm incapacitated. So what happens in that situation?
That's why you need to do one now.
Okay.
These are called pre-need documents because you need to do them before you need them. You have to execute them before you need them.
Do you submit them to all the hospitals in the area or how does that work?
No, I don't. I tell you, when I've gone to the hospital, they always ask me, do you have this? And you have a medical power of attorney and a directive to physicians. And generally, I'll say yes. And they say, you know where they are? I see my wife has them. But I've taken them with me to the hospital before, but they just stick them in the file. But I don't know. There's so many different medical entities, I don't know how you could get it to all of them, you know, but just if somebody knows where they are and that's what they just want to make sure you have it. And, you know, the thing about the directed physicians that's sort of interesting to me is all of these documents, once you execute them, if you become incapacitated, you can't revoke them to the best of my knowledge. The one that's a directed to physicians that says keep, you know, let me die or whatever, even if you're mentally incapacitated, you can revoke that. It's sort of an interesting little twist.
And so when people, let's say someone's going to go get their documents done, their wills, they take care of typically all of those things at the same time?
Yes. I've always done them as a package.
Makes sense.
And I don't, people say, because I don't want to be trying to sell somebody separate documents, try to talk them into each document, you know? And plus, it's just easier to do them all at the same time. And in my firm, we do a lot of flat fee stuff for that, which better for clients and better for the attorneys too, because you have to do all that billing. But we just do a package, and we have it on the fee schedule. It lists what's going to be in there. And it maybe has some burial instructions in it or that sort of thing, you know?
That's a really good point. One of the fears is that every time they pick up the telephone, that it's going to cost them more money to take care of it. So having a flat fee just makes so much sense. And from my experience, I think the clients appreciate that sort of an arrangement more.
So, John, one of the things that people may not realize is that estate plans need to be updated as life changes. How often should people revisit their estate plan, and what kind of events should trigger a review?
You know, if a will is written properly, then it's pretty much going to be valid for a long time. But if things, if you change your marriage, or maybe if a family member dies, that's a good thing to put in there. In a lot of the wills I do, I don't put a lot of the specifics of what people own in the will, because that's going to change over time, or it's likely to change. But if you have that specific information in it, and you know, it's not probably a good idea to update it every, maybe, I don't know how often, maybe 10 years or something like that. But they do last. I mean, most of these documents are pretty good for the durations.
All right.
That's not a good answer. That's not a good business answer, but...
No,
it makes sense. You know, if something changes in your life, then it would make sense to revisit those things,
whether it be
a marriage, birth of a child.
Of course, yeah.
Death of somebody that maybe you had appointed to be the executor,
exactly,
getting older.
Yeah, yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. And it's good to know that they're flexible, too.
And when the tax laws change a lot,
right.
It may be if that estate tax exemption amount comes down enough, people might want to look at that and see if it's going to be so that they need to put some more tax planning language in their wills or their trusts. So,
all right, let's lighten things up a little bit here, John. I've been talking about too many morbid things. So outside of the courtroom and the office, what's something our listeners might be surprised to learn about you? Do you have any hobbies or passions that keep you grounded?
I used to sail a lot until I broke my toe. I'm still healing on that. So, and I do a lot of music. So I've always done music since I had that music degree. In fact, I was across the street last night at HCC rehearsing with the jazz band.
Oh, wow.
I'm not playing in it. I'm writing for it, but
writing
music
that's pretty cool.
That's awesome. It's a lot of fun. A lot of work.
That's a lot of work.
I mean,
you're actually writing the music just from scratch?
Yeah. Well, some of them I've written the music, the tunes and everything. Some of them I'm arranging somebody else's tune. So, but it's very time consuming. And I enjoy doing it, so I don't mind doing it, but it takes up a lot of time. Yeah.
That is pretty cool. So let's talk about the future for you. So as you continue to help families secure their legacies, what's next for you? You know, are there any projects or goals that you're working towards in the estate planning field?
I recently merged my practice. I was fortunate enough to be kind of too busy. And so I merged my practice with this other firm, Hayes & Wilson, that I've been there since April. And it's really been a good merger. It's good people, and they have – what I needed was more support staff, because and they have plenty of support staff there, and they have a very good – it's not a very big firm, but they have a very good corporate atmosphere sort of a thing. People are happy there, and I've been real happy there. And I don't know that – I don't really have any intention of retiring anytime soon. I'm
All
enjoying
right.
it there, you know.
That's good to hear.
Nice.
You can tell you like what you do. You have a passion for it.
Yeah, I do. I like it very much.
And it sounds like the firm that you're describing is – they're capable of acting as a big law firm would, but with a small, more family-friendly kind of feel to it. Is that
they are, and they're very organized, and they do a lot of stuff. They do as much as possible by a flat fee. And it brings cost down for the client, because if you're having to send out bills every month, and it's time-consuming, and it starts to really grate on people.
So they don't have to worry about calling in and, you know, getting charged X amount of dollars just for a 10-minute call?
That's right, yeah. And people really don't like that.
Yeah, that's annoying. All right, John, before we close, we like to end each episode with something we call favorites. This is where we ask you to share something with our listeners that you've been enjoying lately. It could be a book, a movie, a podcast, or even a piece of wisdom. What's something you've been into recently that you'd recommend?
It's hard for me to answer because I'm so involved in the music right now that's kind of what I'm
doing. Sure, yeah.
I have been so fortunate to get into this program at Houston Community College. I'm studying under the direction of three of the top musicians around. One's a pianist named Joe LoCascio, and a composer and arranger. One's Woody Witt, who's a great band director and a really, really good tenor player. And one is, I'm studying with he's not there now, but a guy named Dennis Dotson, who's one of the best trumpet players around. And I just started working with him a couple of weeks ago. Now that I have a firm where I have some time to breathe, you know.
Right.
So it's just, so that's the highlight for me right now.
That's awesome.
And my kids are home from college, so I play with them every now and then.
All right.
I love to hear that. That's great. And you know, it's just so refreshing having you here to talk about a subject that can be very complex in terms that regular people can understand. And I think that that's a really big deal. So thanks again, John. Your insights into estate planning have been invaluable. And I'm sure that anyone listening has gained a lot from today's conversation. And for those who haven't yet started their estate planning journey, hopefully this will inspire them to take the first step. And actually, on that note, what's the if somebody wanted to find out more about you, more about your firm and take that first step, how do they find you?
Well, I tend to use my cell phone number a lot because it's so easy to do.
But don't give that out on that.
But the firm is, it's in the Heights. It's in one of the high-rise buildings in the Heights. And I don't even know if I can remember the phone number. I haven't been there long enough. I don't ever call myself there.
What's the name of the firm?
It's called Hayes & Wilson, PLLC. H-A-Y-E-S and Wilson, PLLC. And my email address is john@hayeswilsonlaw.com.
And I'm sure that people can Google you, Google the firm, and you should come right up. I'm pretty sure because I think that's how we had just pulled up your website.
Since I'm transitioning from my solo practice to their firm, I'm on their website and I have my own website under John Yao Law, PLLC. And people like it for some reason. They like that website, so I get a lot of business from it. But I'm only going to give you the phone number for Hayes & Wilson. I just can't seem to pull up on my phone right now.
And for the listeners, they can always go through us, and we know how to find John and his telephone number as well. So,
all right. Now, for our listeners, just a few closing comments. Estate planning isn't just about securing wealth. It's about securing peace of mind for you and your loved ones. And having a trusted expert like John Yao guiding you through that process makes all the difference.
Yeah, and thanks again, John, for sharing your time and expertise with us. Thank you to our listeners, and thank you again for tuning in to Dollars and Cents, Wealth, Wisdom, and Well-Being. Until next time, take care and plan well.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.